If you're a member of Renegade University, you know that over the last year, we've been looking for a teacher to teach Introduction to Cryptocurrency, a course that many of you have been demanding. Well, we found our guy. He's Vin Armani, who's well known in the crypto world as an educator and an entrepreneur, and he was on a recent episode of Unregistered, which has gotten a huge response. Vin will be teaching a four-part webinar called From Satoshi to Financial Sovereignty, an Introduction to Cryptocurrency. It begins April 19th and runs for four consecutive Mondays. If you want to take this course, and it is filling up fast, go to renegadeuniversity.com and you'll see it on the front page, or you can click video courses on the left side and it'll come right up for you. Again, this is Vin Armani, the great Vin Armani's course, From Satoshi to Financial Sovereignty, four-part webinar, an introduction to cryptocurrency beginning April 19th. Go to renegadeuniversity.com and sign up fast. Thank you.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and to expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think.
If you're looking for the smartest takes on politics, I really don't know why you would look anywhere other than to this week's guest, who's a self-described queer hippie conservative who talks about perfume. This is my interview with Jack, the Perfume Nationalist. I am joined from Austin, Texas, once again by one of my very favorite people in the whole internet, Jack of the Perfume Nationalist podcast. Thanks for coming back on, Jack. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me again. I'm okay. As far as like COVID fascism, I'm, you know,
right,
not great, but
I was just on your show and a few weeks ago, and I told you at the time that, and this is the total truth, I thought about, because you planned that like months in advance. So I had it in my head that I was going to be on your show in January for months. And I have never like pre-planned, thought about, or been as anxious about any appearance on someone else's podcast ever. And I had to do more homework for it than any other as well, but I loved it. I had to watch two movies and think a lot. And I had to be interesting, and perfume, I had to be interesting about perfume, which was completely not in my wheelhouse. But how did I do?
Oh, you did great. I mean, it's flattering that you were nervous about being on that, but
oh, yeah.
I don't know. I don't think about them after we record them. And, you know, I used to like read entire books in preparation for them and be really obsessive about it, but like, now I just kind of hit record.
Well, that's what we're doing today. We did a little bit of prep for this one. I asked you, we were texting, and I asked you what your major influences were, and I sort of knew some of them. So I have a list, and we're going to get into that. I told you a long time ago, I want you to teach a course at Renegade University. I don't know what it would be titled, but I just want people to learn from you kind of the world according to Jack. Like you have a very distinctive, particular, one might say unique, worldview, right? I mean, there aren't that many people. Now, you've borrowed from various influences, various sources, but there really is no other Jack as far as I know. And it's a fascinating combination of ideas. So I kind of I want to do that today a little bit, give people a little introduction to the world that is your mind, which is a fascinating place. But first, let's just talk about, we got to talk about COVID fascism. We got to talk about what's going on. We got to talk about the stuff that you and I get pissed off about all the time, just politics. And then we'll get into the deeper stuff. But so you work in hospitality, they call it, and mm-hmm. you have for a long time, and you have to wear a mask all day at work, right?
Yeah, the entire time, ever since masks were normalized in, I guess, April, I've been wearing one 40 hours a week the entire time, and seeing it for what it actually is and complaining about it online and getting the resultant kind of contrarian backlash about, like, if you have a problem with this, then it's just because you're the problem, which is just like, you're stupid and wrong. I'm sorry. If you're for this COVID stuff, you're stupid and wrong, and you're on the wrong side of history, and you're a fascist, and that's all there is to say about it. But So like any kind of news of COVID mandates being lifted, masks going away, such as the news from Greg Abbott this week, that doesn't affect people who have to actually work in public's lives, because they will always be punished with the mask in order to make rich people who have email jobs and just have to wear the mask when they go out to Whole Foods feel safe. So that's the new organization of society, is that the lower classes have to wear masks 40 hours a week, and the upper classes can do their little show of solidarity with their COVID performance. Something really funny to me that's been happening recently, like twice a week, is that women will ask me to like deliver a little gift or something to another resident, because they don't want, they're too embarrassed of being seen like potentially breaking COVID protocol. But it's fine if like a man forced to wear a tie and look bad and old before his young years is made to do it. Not to complain, I mean, I have a good job, but I'm alone most of the time, but still, it's just, yeah, there's a difference. If you have to work, then you have to wear the mask. If you don't, then you live in a little fantasy land, and rich people already do, because they forget their keys all the time. They love leaving things at front desks. They're like children.
So you work, where do you work at a condo complex? Is that it?
Yeah, I work at a condo.
Yeah. And so you're basically work the front desk.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, and and it's a fairly well-to-do condo, upscale.
Yeah. I mean, before that I worked at a hotel, so.
Yeah,
I've been working with, like, this is way, way better. I'm much more appreciated at current job, so I don't want to complain too much. It's the fault of society, of the mask stuff. It's not their individual fault, but that's the way that it's going.
But your career is basically serving rich people.
Yeah, and this whole like podcast growth thing was to eventually maybe escape from that. Which people think is really funny and like mock me for.
Really?
Oh yeah, people hate, like, the whole like hate machine against me is so, it's so built into it that I like am this like schlub that works hospitality jobs from all the like leftists, you know, that they care about this imaginary proletariat. It's all from them too.
See, I love that. Like, you're a you're truly working class, right?
Like, and they say you shouldn't listen to me because of how I look. Yeah.
I know. You're truly working class. You work 40 hours a week helping rich people get into their condos. And these leftists claim to speak for the working class, but think you are what? Toxic, evil? I mean, what?
Yeah. I mean, it's just like when you develop the kind of parasocial hate brigade that's such a part of this whole podcast thing, they're not really even talking about you. It's just a way of belonging, feeling like they belong to a certain group by like attacking this like invented, like hyperbolic straw man version of you. And, you know, they can feel kind of they can get some attention online. They can feel kind of popular for saying like the right thing, having chosen the right villains, whatever. It's, you know, it's really not even about you.
Right.
Like these, if you met these people in person, they would, first of all, they would be scared of me.
Yeah, because you're big, right?
Yeah. No, I'm 5'3". I'm just kidding. I'm 6'4".
Are you 6'4"?
Yeah. I mean, that's what my driver's license says. It might be 6'3", but I always wear boots, so.
You know, it's funny. Freddie DeBoer, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's like a lefty, but it really, he's kind of a red pilled lefty blogger, basically, who's also just gotten more hate than anybody could ever imagine in his career as a blogger over the last decade or so. But he just wrote a piece yesterday, I think, in which he talked about all these legions of people who scream at him online. When they meet him in person, they're just like, "Hi, Freddie, how are you doing?" They're so nice to him. You know, they will not ever betray. They will not ever like suggest that they had any negative feelings about him whatsoever. It's just so phony.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody likes me in person, especially people who like have no idea about like any of my politics or anything, which aren't even controversial. But everybody is fine with me in person. It's just online, like, has a dehumanizing, gross effect, which I totally agree with. When you see someone summed up by their like sassy little tweets trying to get attention, it's a gross depiction of a person.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing when you see like people you know in your real life's online presence too. Like it's kind of shameful, but it's just how things work in the present moment, I guess.
so you're a huge, as am I, a huge critic of what's called liberalism. You call it neoliberalism, whatever the dominant liberal.
I call it liberalism.
Sure, whatever.
I like calling it leftism to make those people mad online because they're like, "We're not liberals, we're left." I'm like, "No, you're just a liberal." I like using outdated terms that make people mad, like liberalism. Because, I mean, you know exactly what it is when you're talking about it. 2010's liberalism, that's what I call it. I don't like using the word woke anymore because that's kind of like diminishes the problem. People like know what it is now if you say woke, but it makes it sound funny when it's not funny. It's Nazism.
Yeah. So you're not, I was born and raised in the heart of liberalism and leftism, really, in Berkeley. But you live in Austin, but you're not from there, right?
Yeah, I'm from Austin.
Oh, you were born and raised in Austin.
Mm-hmm. I'm an actual Austinite.
So just like me, just like a liberal college town. Exactly, mm-hmm. Like Berkeley. Yeah, okay. So you've always been around these people that you are critiquing and who you kind of hate politically all the time. What is it? What do they do?
But like the thing that I hate didn't exist until the 2010s. Like around regular people, it was so...
Yeah.
You know, like feminism had retreated back to this like this kooky academic fringe thing that was just in the media.
Right.
Like 2010's liberalism didn't infect regular people or take over the discourse in the way that it currently has until like 2013. So, yeah, Austin, like, I like the hippy dippy, like, qualities of Austin that, you know, that are, there's a little of that. There's a kind of lazy attitude, but, you know, as it's been overstated a million times, like, it's just full of Californians.
Especially, now. Yeah, more and more. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what do liberals say? What do they do with you when they find out what you think? I can tell you what my mother does. She psychoanalyzes. She wants when she comes across, you know, it's very rare, when she comes across someone other than me whose politics aren't right, she wants to know what happened to you in your childhood to cause such a thing. Do they ever do that?
Yeah, they've done that. It's really creepy and invasive. Like, I can't say, you know, putting myself out there, I can't say I don't ask for it, because the way that I psychoanalyze like women in generalizations, which, you know, it's true, that's why they don't like it, but you know, I guess I deserve it for doing that. But most of the psychoanalysis isn't exactly accurate. It's just kind of like when Silence of the Lambs, when Lecter says you're just two generations away from poor white trash. It's just that kind of thing. Like, it's always very class-based. It's about my appearance. It's
oh, wow.
You know, or just, 90%. That was the thing. Okay, speaking of my idols, one of my idols is Lena Dunham.
Yeah.
And when you do something like this, you really, until you experience it, don't expect 95% of the dialogue about your project to be about your parents. Like, unless you're like a child star, I guess, trained by the media to, you know, to ignore it from an early age, it's quite shocking, and it requires like navigating, you know, this whole like e-celebrity sort of disgusting thing.
Yeah. especially women. I mean, I've done like interviews with women for my show and for other outlets, and the YouTube comments when it's a woman, especially if it's a woman who's not, you know, conventionally beautiful or whatever. And I had, I mean, it just, it's really beyond, I mean, I've had it too. I mean,
I know. And the only solution is like not to talk about it. But I just like, I find it really hard to not talk about that when you're talking about the whole podcast kind of like online cultural critic scene, because it's just a part of it. And I like made my image a part of my project in the way that like Lena Dunham did, in a kind of exhibitionist way. And people get more mad if you're just kind of like normal looking and mouthing off or doing something confidently than they do if you're like the elephant man, you know. If you're like an obvious freak, they're not going to get mad. But if you're just kind of normal, then it's vipers.
Oh yeah. Well, because they're, it's sort of like, wait a minute, you're supposed to be one of us, you know? It's like the enemy within, you know, it's like the virus that's infected us. So yeah, I mean, well, okay. So then you tell us what did happen to you as a child, Jack, to produce these aberrant ideas.
It wasn't really as a child. I mean, as a teenager, I started to think that people were just, or started to gather that people were just generally very closed-minded and uncreative and conformist. But like even like regular people were very open-minded and accepting in the 2000s. It was not just because I was a kid and I'm nostalgic, but like all of the big problems that they've drudged up again were pretty much solved. I didn't experience any substantial homophobia ever. Mm-hmm. Everything like
really
bad in the way of like harassment or like meanness that I've ever experienced has been from liberals as an adult. But yeah, the big turn was not in childhood, though. Like I followed the path that like most gay men follow, where you're like closer, you're sort of emerged from the female world, you're closer to your mother, more comfortable with women, kind of understand them. Boys seem like a sort of exotic and boring until you hit puberty and it reverses and you don't want to be around girls and you want the approval from men. And every single thing that I do is for approval from straight men. I'm a total pick me. So that's what happened in childhood. As you're, if you're gay, you're trying to eternally capture that like approval from straight, athletic, normal guys. Because like, you know, whenever like a straight man is like tries to get me to throw something to them, it's like sweaty terror. And I like go back to my childhood. So that's what it is. It's being like the awkward, effeminate boy that can't throw the ball. Even though I played football, was 18 first string 2 years in a row, I still have no idea how to play football. But yeah, I'm a pick me for men. That's what happened.
I was going to say, you're 6'4", big dude living in Texas. You had to be forced to play football. I mean.
Oh, right? Yeah. And I wish I had continued, because then I would be indomitable if I was also a football player. Yeah. You know, but then, you know, in the 2000s, it's like you discover, you like read Shock Value by John Waters and you're like, I'm going to misbehave. I'm going to be steel lipstick and cool drag stuff. You know, that's just what you did if you were kind of arty in the 2000s. But now I just wish I had continued playing football, and I'm actually quite nostalgic for it. But even though I do so, you know, it's Full Metal Jacket when I put in those situations, it's really embarrassing. I become, you know. But they, all the guys were really nice. They like defended me. I even like did gay stuff, wore like purple nail polish, and one of the coaches tried to fuck with me. And like all the guys were like, leave him alone, man. He's cool. So it was sweet.
I gotta believe, was this just because it was Austin? I mean, other parts.
I mean, it's not, it wasn't Austin proper.
Okay.
It's a suburb that was, you know, weird in its own way, but I mean, it was like Baptist evangelical in the kind of 2000s way that all those places were. Yeah. You know, no, there wasn't any kind of like a Austin element that really facilitated my, you know, acceptance. It was sheer personality and force.
So you had no idea how to play football, though. Still don't.
I tried. I tried buying the Madden 64 video game to learn how to play football. I like sold off all my Final Fantasy games because those were gay and bought this boring football game. And I just like couldn't. And the most I've been into football, I guess, was this year, the Super Bowl. I liked Tom Brady and that everybody hates Tom Brady for being perfect. So that's kind of where I can get into the game is like Tom Brady is perfect and wins at everything and losers are mad.
And he supports Trump.
Yeah. And he's a Trump supporter and he didn't wear a mask. So yeah, that's,
and he's hot,
whatever. And like the guys have big asses, but I guess it's pads, but it looks like you have a big ass underneath that.
Right. Now, do you prefer football players to baseball players? Because I thought baseball players were really like
those. I mean, I like both at a glance, but baseball is really cute. But that's like Yankee stuff. Like, do they have baseball in Texas? I don't.
Yes, they're called the Rangers.
Okay. And well, baseball still makes me think of that, like, you know, kind of like Woody Allen, like going to the game, Yankee kind of inscrutable Yankee hobbies.
Well, I always thought that women and gay men liked the way that the pants looked, especially on the baseball players.
I don't think women like men having big asses. They think it's effeminate.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's kind of that's the domain of gay men.
The reason that I stopped being a baseball fan was when a young adult, he said, man, they wear belts. That's not a sport. They wear belts in baseball. How could it be a sport if you're wearing belts? Think about that.
I don't know. Yeah, I like the vibe of baseball, football. Generally support sports now that they're demonized and you're supposed to stay in your apartment.
Right. So you like anything that's demonized?
No, I mean, that makes it sound like I'm just a contrarian, but like, you know, I like that like normal well-adjusted people have their hobbies like sports that they can get into rather than buying like 3 backup bottles of a Comme des Garçons perfume. I like normal well-adjusted people that have no interest in any of the stuff that I like.
Now, speaking of like gender norms and not fitting them. So your brain obviously wasn't fitted to sports in those ways. I mean, you just didn't get it. You thought it was boring. But it's not as if, I mean, there is something about men's brains generally. I don't want to essentialize here too much, but I know that in general, straight and gay men do something similar. Their object is different. Like their object of interest is different. So straight men are interested in sports. Gay men are interested in things like perfume, whatever. But there is like a cataloging that goes on. Like, and so you're a great example of this, right? Because like, you know, perfume the way that I know the 1990 Major League Baseball rosters, you know.
This is very true. This is something one of my like best female friends pointed out to me long ago, that men have an obsessive like encyclopedic cataloging instinct their hobbies and interests. That women just usually do not have. Like women, you could use this even as a way to say that like women are better than men because they're less like sentimental about this kind of stuff. But yeah, women will, you know, just get rid of everything, you know, when they get a new boyfriend, just throw away all of their interests. They're really adaptable. That's why they keep winning. They're like the Terminator 2, they just adapt to, and they just like they adapted to COVID. Like they're like, oh, this is how it is now.
Yeah, look at my cute mask. I got it at the
game. Yeah, and then men are all eternally like No Country for Old Men, like sad, haggard, mourning what once was.
Right. Well, I was thinking, I mean, I would rather be a woman because for many reasons. One of them is that thing, and I have this, you know, I catalog things constantly. So like, you know, bring up a perfume, the name of a perfume, and Jack will tell you the year it came out, the history of it, you know, what the company was doing at the time, the controversy surrounding it. You'll have, you know, all these, you'll have a whole essay basically ready for every perfume, right? And you have it like, you have shelves in your mind, right? With all the perfumes perfectly lined up and alphabetized. And I have that too, you know, with other things, right? Politics is a classic example, right? Where we just know the names and dates of everything, right? That's a very typical male thing, right? But I've got to think that there's like all that stuff is like a it's something that's standing between us, our eyes, our ears, our noses, our mouths, and the pleasure itself, right? It's like there's the perfume over here and all the pleasure you get from it, and then, or the baseball game, right? And all the pleasure you get. And then there's like all this thinking about it and like stuffing all of the elements of it into these other, these boxes and the creation of boxes and the creation of categories, et cetera, right?
Men like being experts on things, especially like obscure subjects. And yeah, I guess it could get in the way of the pleasure, but I think the social instincts of women, which makes them adaptable, but also gets us in the current state that we're in when they're given total Caligula-like control over political and cultural discourse, that everything has to be done for social approval, conformity, social acceptance, a constantly evolving model of what that is. So that's the most furthest mutated version of this like feminine instinct that also allows them to not be nostalgic about bullshit that doesn't matter. Men just, I don't know, it's something that like makes your day pass. I just think about perfume and like movies and stuff all day, because working is really boring, because I've never had a job. If you have a job that you really like that you can throw yourself into, like my dad has one, he loves doing it. Then it's different. But I just am a stupid like Lena Dunham millennial that just ended up in hospitality because I don't have a trust fund or whatever. And yeah,
you know, I've said to many people over the last 4 years that this podcast has been the most satisfying and rewarding work I've ever done, and I will say that unexpectedly, it's had another consequence that has been so rewarding, I'm sort of blown away by it, which is that Unregistered Listeners, this podcast, has helped build a business. So Paloma Verde CBD, as I've told you many times, had a brick and mortar store open in San Antonio, ready to go a year ago, just a little more than a year ago. And of course, the shutdown kiboshed that, and they lost money and time and resources on that. And they decided to go online, but they didn't know if they could do that. They had no experience with that at all. And they came to me and they asked for me to sponsor the show. And I said, sure. And I started to get the word out. And you all started buying their products. And the thing is, you bought them because you liked them so much, you bought them again and again and again. Carlos and Vanessa are constantly telling me there are many, many repeat customers. I tried their products and I loved them, and I told you that and you believe me, and you've been telling your friends apparently. But Unregistered Listeners, Carlos and Vanessa have told me, are absolutely the basis of the success of Paloma Verde, which was hanging by a thread just a year ago because of the government. Anyway, go to palomaverdestore.com. Use the discount code Renegade. You get 25% off every single thing in their store. Then join their mailing list, you get another 10% off. Okay, so that's 35% off if it's your first order. They've also put together my three favorite Paloma Verde products into what's called the Unregistered Combo Pack, also known as the Thad Pack. That's what the cool kids call it. So that includes the gummies, which have 10 milligrams of CBD in each one. These things are so good. This is a new one, I think. That's right, I already got into this one. They're so good, many different flavors. Love them, eat them like candy. And they're soft gels. This is the medicine. 25 milligrams per soft gel. Use them every day. Fantastic stuff. My favorite thing, though, because it's so fast acting, is the tincture. Put some drops under your tongue, and for me, my anxiety and insomnia melt away. So again, go to palomaverdestore.com. Use the discount code Renegade. Get 25% off everything. 10% off joining the mailing list. 33% off the Unregistered Combo Pack. Help build this business and make your body feel better and make your life better. It's a win-win-win, you know, like a lot of some things are. Thank you so much.
When I heard your episode on Lena Dunham, I forget, this was several months ago, right? You did an episode where you talked about her a lot.
That was like one of the early ones, but I recently went on Thought Topics and talked about Lena Dunham like last week.
Oh, I heard this was on your show. I heard you talking.
Oh, that was like November 2019.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. I was in the back catalog. But yeah, I was absolutely flabbergasted. Now, I'm totally unfair, as are most critics of Lena Dunham, in that I have never even seen a minute of Girls. I have no idea, but I just, as a public personality, as a public persona, she's like the worst of the worst, right?
Oh yeah. If you just see, I mean, I go over it so much, but part of the problem with her is that the narrative is incorrect and incomplete, because the important stuff that was happening with Tiny Furniture and Girls, that was liberals waging this morality crusade against her, against what they called hipster racism and, you know, nepotism, and they projected all of this stuff onto her. She got, initially, she got a lot of feverish coverage and praise, and she was of course given an HBO show at like age 23, and so this, the sour grapes at Jezebel, who were mad that it wasn't them, stirred up this controversy about her, where actually it was, you know, she's bad, this is bad. But that was all liberals at first, and then conservatives didn't take the bait until, or take any interest in her until her book came out, and they started this ridiculous, stupid little tale that she molested her sister, that I still see bandied about in the most embarrassing corners of like right wing Twitter, you know.
Right.
But that's when conservatives took an interest. And she, her problem was that she's, she has a natural satirical creative instinct that was squashed entirely because she exists in this New York elite celebrity art world that's constantly telling her that everything that's actually good about her is wrong. And she's totally insane now. I mean, she's like padded walls nuts now. I hope she's doing better, but like the criticism got to her, which I understand.
I didn't know that she went that far off the deep end, but I just remember her. I first found out about her when she was talking about, I think this was her, wasn't it her? Talking about cultural appropriation in the Oberlin cafeteria.
Oh, well, that was way later. That was after like 6 years of relentless brainwashing from the worst people on earth, just using her as an example of all of their little stupid cultural appropriation liberal agendas, where Lena Dunham is just the most evil person who ever lived, the toxic example of whiteness. But the narrative is incorrect because people did not like her. Like right-wing people, especially conservatives, try to view her as this sort of body pos feminist liberal thing that was launched. No, Broad City is what people thought Girls was supposed to be. Broad City is stupid. But Girls was actually like off-putting pornographic experimental art. But like there was never this like big feverish fan base of like body positive Lena Dunham fans. Everybody was mad about her, except seemingly me and like a few people I knew who liked her. It's just kind of like trying to put her in this category. And like, to a lesser extent, I think the kind of demonization from conservatives of Amy Schumer is also really stupid, because Amy Schumer was funny when she came out.
Yes.
And she actually was not like a preachy woke. Like, she held out for a long time, but they relentlessly drilled into her, you have to disavow your, you know, writer who made this terrible joke, who sexually harassed a woman. And eventually she gave into it, because they all do, because they're in the Hollywood system. But like, Amy Schumer wasn't bad. I feel Pretty was good. Trainwreck was awful, but like, yeah, people are like, Amy Schumer. No, that's not the real like body positive feminist thing that you're railing against. She's funny.
So what's the genius of Lena Dunham, though? Explain this for those of us for whom this is a totally alien concept.
When Tiny Furniture and Girls came out, I just felt like nothing movie or TV wise had ever truthfully depicted the experience of my particular age group. And like, when I got into Tiny Furniture and watched it and was totally surprised at how good it was, I was like 24 or something, like living with my parents in this, in like a hipster city, kind of aimless, getting drunk all the time. I really related to her comedic exhibitionistic nudity, like placing herself in the frame, like Tiny Furniture looks like 2001 A Space Odyssey. It looks like spacey and incredible. And then you see her just like kind of lumbering forth in these panties in every scene. And the exhibitionistic nudity is what really got me into it.
Huh.
And girls, the same thing. People are just constantly mad about it and constantly trying to say they're forcing nude Lena Dunham on us as a body positive thing. No, no one likes it except weirdos. It's a surreal element of the show. It's not like body acceptance, cringe, liberal weirdness. Like, she's trolling. It's brilliant.
Okay. I didn't.
But the ruthless, like, the also, you know, there was this moral panic over what they called hipster racism then, because originally being a hipster was like not politicized. It was they were really mean, really sexual, said the N-word. Well, I think of like Dove Charney from American Apparel and like Terry Richardson and like Gavin McInnes and like that crew. That was what being a hipster was initially like. And then the 2010s came around and it was suffused with the woke liberalism, but these successive panics over like cultural appropriation, Me Too, campus rape, whatever.
Well, Gavin McInnes invented the word hipster, right?
Yeah.
And then he gets kicked out of Vice, and then Vice becomes totally social justice-y after that. And they dragged hipsters with them, apparently.
But Lena Dunham was nailed to the cross, because early on, Tiny Furniture and Girls do troll about racial stuff in a way that movies simply do not now. Tiny Furniture especially, because it's like straight out of her mind in college, and it feels like she's from a pretty like cool scene of, you know, like kind of witty bohemian sort of proto Red Scare type girls. But the fact that the show didn't have artificial propagandistic racial diversity, that was why it could never be accepted by people.
Okay.
And because it was like realistic in the way that like they were just white people mostly have white friends. Everyone knows this.
Now I remember that was the controversy about Girls, was that it was an all-white cast. How dare she depict white Manhattanites hanging out with other white Manhattanites, which is what happens. Yeah. Oh God.
And there were like good-natured jokes about like other races, you know, like it just kind of casual stuff that wouldn't cause anyone to bat an eye before 2012, you know. It's just like mentioning or acknowledging racial differences in any way except absolute religious self-abasement.
Totally.
That's what she got, you know, driven insane for.
Gotcha. All right. So the 2010s, you keep going on about the 2010s, the 2010s, the 2010s. I want to hear this. I mean, you've mentioned this many times to me, but I want to hear the full thing. Like what happened in the 2010s? So this is the Obama administration. Is that relevant? I mean, what else? Yeah, what are the big markers, and what happened? Like, I've never thought about it that way until I heard you talk about it. I've never thought about the 2010s as being particularly distinctive in these ways, but I'd say you've half convinced me when I think about, especially, I think you're especially brilliant when you talk about the aesthetic changes in mainstream culture after in the 2010s and since then.
Mm-hmm.
But why don't you just lay that out? Like, what happened in the 2010s? First of all, how old were you in 2010?
I'm 33 now, turning 34 this year. Okay, so I was 23
young
in 2010.
Okay.
So let's see, the whole trajectory. It's actually somewhat simple. Okay. Everyone my age, including me, voted for Barack Obama in 2008 because guess what? The propaganda works. Why not? Like, it was just about having a cool black president. You know, it's not like the alternative was any more appealing. It's not like the Bushes were more appealing. But yeah, I mean, I was 18 years old. I was a dumb kid. So it's yeah, almost, I voted for him.
It was almost as good as having a black friend. Not quite.
Yeah, yeah. But none of it had been, you know, the machinations and schemes had not been revealed yet. And that was fine. That sort of 2008 to 2012 was a sort of last hurrah of the 2000s. There was this like fun, decadent, gay feeling in pop culture with like Lady Gaga and like all the Madonna spider babies at their peak before they developed feminist morality and became really tedious. It was a fun moment. And then the second Obama administration, that's when they revived the problem of racism in a very cynical way. And it happened gradually, but that coincided with when all of my friends went to college, and I noticed a change in all of my female friends who were once very open-minded. And then they went to their African American studies class or their, you know, feminist whatever class. And suddenly they were stricken by these terrors at all times, could not watch certain things. And it was obviously all very fake and performed because they'd learned it. But yeah, you know, they suddenly could not watch rape scenes, which had this supernatural power to re-rape the viewer if they were exposed to it. They would have these outbursts. These people I had known for years would have these unhinged outbursts when we were like drinking or something about like James Bond and David Lynch and they were just trained to see things in the feminist way. Okay, so I noticed that simultaneous. The trans ideology I first saw on Tumblr when, I mean, it felt like glimpsing into some kind of horrible hardcore pornography that you're not supposed to see.
Yep.
Like that's popping up on the screen. But I saw these like really horrible men with like PayPal buttons on their accounts demanding that you feed them money through like a mousetrap sequence of events. Their gender identity did not allow them to go to their part-time job, and so it was up to you, the cis white person, to feed them money to get tattoos. It's not your right to question. It's always the Rube Goldberg machine. This is all the all the gender nonconformists. Right. There's always a Rube Goldberg mechanism of like the like D.W. Griffith's intolerance, like which led them to not be able to get to work that day. The car ran out of gas, but they have like a neurotic fear of like the smell of gas that's unmedicated because we don't have Medicaid for all, and we don't have universal health insurance, and so they were stuck by the side of the road. And they also they can't talk to their rich parents because they had to move to Austin or Portland or whatever to the punk house because their rich parents misgendered them once. So the rich parents meanwhile are like calling them every day trying to get a hold of them, but they're unlikable, terrible people that have made bad decisions, so they don't answer. And yeah, it's always about this like neurotic kind of like I have all of these disorders, that agoraphobia that doesn't allow me to go work the 14 hours to make my beer money this week. So it's up to you. And you there's also a literal Holocaust of trans women happening right now. This idea, this invented Holocaust of trans women that they trotted out, which is, you know, has now reached the mainstream, is really funny. It's my favorite part of it. That's just every day, just trans women are just being murdered right open in the streets, gore everywhere. And everyone just turns a blind eye. Nobody does anything about it. They're just this hacked to pieces, like South Park. So that happened, but I thought this is an obscure thing that won't go anywhere. And it's now that's like our politicians just like have a PayPal button, and they're, you know, white people is racist, please donate. That happened. And then the first big wave of brainwashing came when they invented cultural appropriation. Oh, first we should mention Jezebel. Okay, Jezebel was integral in the revival of feminism into this new mutant, stupid, mean form for young people. Because feminism, before that, all the girls that I knew, the smart ones, like, hey, they hated feminism. They would say, oh, I don't like that hairy-legged feminist. They're annoying. And then Jezebel created it took the tone of the MTV show Daria and the gossip rag qualities of Gawker that birthed it, and the spectral rape, persecution, gangbang of morality crusades from Tumblr, and created this thing that was very accessible and desirable to young girls because it gave them infinite power. And so Jezebel happened, and then cultural appropriation. There was about a whole year where there were continuous moral panics about Indian headdresses because everyone knows so many Native Americans, you know, and there's so many of them around. So there was like a whole year of articles about Indian headdresses, and white girls would just eat this all up. They'd be like, oh, what about the Indian headdresses? You would just hear them repeat, because women think everything is real if they read it. It's like they think it's all real. So the Indian headdresses and the Halloween costumes, there was the, like, Halloween became this thing that, where simultaneously it was very popular because it's like satanic and like people who hate their families love it as opposed to Christmas. So the improper Halloween costume panics, where it was like people were like roundly persecuted for putting like tan makeup on, like dumb people learned to like react to the idea of blackface in like a supernatural way without even like considering the history of like how that was like how like white people got into black culture and black music long ago. They just learned that somehow the any darkening makeup, whatever, that's all making all black people experience 400 years of slavery every time that they glimpse it. So there was that. And then the next panic was over Confederate flags. There was the church shooting. And that was the first big time that I saw that like big tech would zap something, like make it unavailable. Before that, you could buy like Confederate flag shirts on Amazon. That was, you know, the physical media thing kind of like gestated around then, because you saw how all the places people bought stuff online could just zap it, just whoop, it's suddenly against our terms of service to sell anything. There was that, and then there was the campus rape stuff, which turned into Me Too. The campus rape stuff was revived from the early 90s. Like, there are all the Paglia essays about it, which are really great. And the Rolling Stone article that kicked it off was total like pornographic romance fiction was proven to be lies from a crazy woman. Which was obvious to me as an editor of romance novels. Because it's all about how, like, you know, these chads do this ceremonial satanic ceremonial rape of her. You know, it's all this fantasy of like chads always want to rape you. It's a big part of the romance. So that was fake, but of course, you know, liberals and journalists are never held accountable for anything that they do. It just goes away. So it didn't matter that started the campus rape thing again. Me Too happened, and conservatives fed into this by pretending that that was real and was addressing real grievances and was not about Hollywood actresses past their relevance, finding a way to revive their careers and gain attention, and professional women to eliminate powerful men from jobs and assume those jobs. And that's what happened with Me Too. But yeah, the like conservatard journalists have always facilitated this by accepting the hypothesis of what liberals put in front of them. It's always like, there's always like a Ben Shapiro type or something who's like, well, Me Too does have real grievances that we must address. And it's like, No, the casting couch is actually not a real grievance that anyone has to address. This is all fake. And it doesn't matter what you think of this. It's also pornography. Mm-hmm. And Democrats have gotten where they are through pornographic rape exploitation fantasies pervaded through the media.
Oh, wow.
It's, I love it. None of it's real. It's pornography. It. All these documentaries are pornography. The Michael Jackson documentary is pornography. The yep. Woody Allen one's pornography. But people feel comfortable with it because it's there, you know, it's within the, it's framed as a morality crusade where they can smugly be like, I, the viewer, I, the jury, you know, will have the right to adjudicate on this incident from 30 years ago that I know nothing about, that I was not a part of, and I feel very important. And I can also get my perverse kicks off, you know.
Jack, if I am ever ruler of the world, I will make sure that every school child will hear that last 10 minutes as the history of the 2010s. That was magnificent.
There's probably a lot more, like,
oh, I'm sure.
But those are the big incidents when you're tracking the rise of 2010s liberalism. Cultural appropriation was huge.
Yeah.
And that was before they came up with the term woke. It was everywhere. It was just a constant ridiculous panic about Indian headdresses. that people, you would go to work and the women would have these sad looks on their faces about, what about the crying Indians? Lana Del Rey wore the headdress in the music video. It's just so wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nothing matters.
Oh God. Do you have any theory as to why all this happened then? Because I don't.
I mean, if I want to get like conspiratorial, preparing us for the COVID New World Order, I think all of that goes into creating a very stupid and religious-minded population that's easily manipulated because they're too scared to speak out. And especially the gender ideology stuff. I mean, that's at the root of all of it, making citizens too scared to state something like the reality of biological gender in public. Mm-hmm. You can do anything to people who are scared to do that.
Right. Okay. A compliant population.
Mm-hmm.
That is also, they think that they are following the orders of the experts, the authorities, people who went to the best universities, right? Mm. Liberals in the Democratic Party, they went to the best schools, right? They went to where the truth is discovered is in universities, right?
Yeah.
And so if you're not part of the university culture, if you're not of that way of thinking and talking, right, then you're not going to find the truth. That's that makes you a Trump supporter, a Republican, a conservative, a redneck, the America of the past. You're embarrassing. You're Donald Trump. You're Jack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and this is why you see like absolute, the most like childish garbage put out by these Twitter accounts, blue check media Twitter accounts, where they're like given these magical like 50,000 followers despite having no engagement and no fans, no nothing.
Right.
It's just like some 23-year-old like girl with a bad attitude with all this like New York Times, Harvard, all the accreditization. Yeah. And they just choose someone to take down, someone who's popular or doing something good, like, you know, or just someone who they can sense misbehaves, and that's their little project. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the girls always do Lana Del Rey. You know, there's always a blue check journalist writing a piece on how Lana Del Rey is actually 100% bad and racist and horrible,
right?
And likes being beaten up and hates feminism, and you know, it's just every 6 months because you can get attention that way. That's easier than coming up with something of your own to get attention on the backs of someone who's risking something.
Exactly. So I asked you, as I said, by text to list your major influences, and I'll read them off here. Okay. And I also have a question about it, but it's a great list. So Camille, do you pronounce it Paglia? I never got this straight.
It's Paglia.
Paglia. Camille Paglia. Todd Haynes. Paglia. Camille Paglia. Todd Haynes, the director. Margaret Mitchell, the author of Gone with the Wind. Kathy Geiswhite, the cartoonist known for the Kathy strip comics. When you wrote that name, I was like, what the hell is this? And I looked it up and thought, oh, Kathy. That's when I was growing up. Samuel Delaney, writer known for sort of being an early queer, I guess, writer and theorist also. Madonna, we've heard of her. John Waters, the filmmaker. Mm-hmm. Those are your peoples. Now, before we get into that, and I want you to talk about all those people if we can. I'm sure you've talked about this somewhere, but I've never on your show or anywhere, I've never heard you talk about drag.
I talk about it a lot.
What's your thinking about it? What's your relationship with it? Your humor reminds me quite a bit of drag humor. Right?
I did drag in high school. I did even bearded drag, yeah. I played women in plays. I played Madame Arcadi in Blythe Spirit. I dressed up as Joan Crawford the last time I dressed up for Halloween, which was like sophomore year.
Right.
I mean, then drag was really exciting.
Yeah.
And I got through it mostly through John Waters. Like, if you're a certain type of 15-year-old, you read John Waters' Shock Value, and then you feel like you have the whole world figured out. And it's like, I've occasionally gotten mad at that book because it is one very lucky boomer's account of how he did everything. But, you know, John Waters could only exist at a particular time and not have to answer for any of it. But yeah, I did drag. I did, you know, my proudest artistic achievement was an all-male production of Little Women. In like 2008, where I played Amy. Awesome. We all had beards. We played Yoko Ono as like the background music. Yeah, I was doing drag, and I love RuPaul. Drag Race in its early years was a very different show.
Yes, yes.
Before a generation passed and woke liberalism ruined it and infected it with ideology. But I mean, it was hilarious. People don't understand. Drag Race was, when it started out, was a satire of America's Next Top Model and Project Runway.
Yeah.
You know, Tyra Banks depicting herself as a god, all-knowing god.
Yeah.
It was really, really clever, and it was really, really un-PC, and like people had not been acclimated to like drag in the way they are now to that point. It was exciting. Mm-hmm.
I might have mentioned to you that I know the guys who make it. Mm-hmm. And they optioned my book. They were going to do something with my book, which is really great, but they're amazing guys. They're so cool. But like, the people don't understand, like, the original couple, two or three seasons of Drag Race are, to me, some of the most brilliant television I've ever seen, period. Like,
oh yeah. Top, I mean, 10. that Sharon, yeah, Needles season, there's a reason that they all are still imitating, yeah, Sharon Needles, doing lame imitations of Sharon, yeah, Needles. There's a whole show, you know, Dragula, that's just Sharon, yeah, Needles imitators.
And RuPaul, I mean, himself is, I think, one of the greatest. I mean, he's one of the last like John Waters types out there, right? He's like,
RuPaul is brilliant. And you know that privately he's very smart, but like John Waters, he's finally achieved the comfort and recognition and money that he always wanted. And he's not going to jeopardize that by,
true,
commenting on what's occurred for the last 5 years. So, although, you know, which I totally get.
Well, yeah, but I wouldn't say he's sold out completely. I mean, he's not fighting strongly, but when the whole anti-tranny thing happened, remember, yeah, that?
But that was like, you know, that might as well have been a million years ago at this point. Because that was,
yeah,
before Trump, yeah, there were lots of liberal celebrities who were saying political correctness has gone too far. I mean, people forget that Joyce Carol Oates used to be a Twitter troll that, yeah, was like hated by millennial liberals because she would always point out that political correctness has gone too far. And then Trump happened and all of those people jumped right back in the closet, and there was suddenly no end to how far political correctness could and should go. But right, RuPaul was one of those in the early controversy over the shemale, you've got a shemale stuff. Yeah, he like
that fight
spoke truth to power about that, but you know, yeah,
that fight, which I'm going to say was around 2010, 2011. Does that sound right? When Dan Savage got,
it was like 2014 or
that late?
It was later than that.
Was it?
Because they were saying shemale until
Well, the big thing that happened was Dan Savage, of all people, went and gave a talk at some college and used the term tranny, like Dan Savage, and got in like all this trouble. He's Mr. Dan Savage is homophobic, of course.
Yeah.
And then I remember at the time, the old drag queens like RuPaul, Lady Bunny, and that whole generation, like all the queens who were like over 40, over 50, they all were on the right side. They all said, no way, tranny is our word. We reclaimed it, yada, yada, you know, forget
it. Which is true.
Yes. And
the word was taken from cross-dressers.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the whole drag ethos, aesthetic, humor, world, culture, it's its own thing. You know, I mean, they were really defending it against this new wave of what you might call neoliberal political correctness, right?
Because
drag still, it's still way incorrect politically. But back then, I mean, it was, to me, the most cutting edge comedy, the most avant-garde of art.
Yeah, it was really dispiriting to see that go down. But since then, so much has happened. The entire history of gay rights has been taken from gay men. Like, gay men are so hated right now. There's this reflect, like we're as hated as just regular cis white straight men. And that's why there's this strange alliance between gay men and like a few straight men as being the only ones who will stand up for basic male sexuality.
Right here. This is it.
Yeah, just basic, like,
we are
basic common sense notions of male sexuality.
You and I are the leaders of the gay straight alliance.
Yeah, but they just deployed narrative after narrative that, like, actually, white gay men weren't responsible for any of that.
So why do you think gay men got thrown under the bus so readily?
Well, men have to be prevented from gathering because they're smart when they're in groups. So,
and therefore dangerous.
All of this is about keeping them apart.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And gay men, I feel like, I don't know if this is accurate, but like generally are like fairly smart, you know, like
in my experience,
like maybe smarter than the average, like just absolute dead-eyed bug. Like, you have to have some kind of like little intellectual process to even end up as like openly gay, or you had to back then. But, you know, now it's just this like shoots and ladders thing where you just end up in this gender nightmare that's not even gay. It's just, it's a political identification.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I always heard that it was because gay men were so successful financially, economically, you know, the wealthiest social group or whatever. I don't even know. I assume that's true. I don't know. But, and, you know, it's true. I mean, gay men have definitely gotten a lot of power in the society. And I suppose that's part of it. Although it's still, well, you know what it is gay marriage. It's they did it to themselves. They chose to become members of the establishment through gay marriage, right? And gay rights and that whole thing. And then they said, we're just like you. We're just like straights. Give us the civil rights. And we did that. And now it's like, and then the woke left is like, okay, fuck you. You're one of them now. So in a way they got what they deserved, I think.
Yeah, they did. And gay marriage was a convenient cause. I always say this, but yeah, gay marriage, as soon as it was passed, liberalism has to, in order to keep itself alive and generating money, always have a new minority to champion and elevate. And once gay marriage was passed, gay men were disposed of very quickly, and immediately the articles about actually gay men are problematic, wealthy, privileged misogynists, those started trickling out. Almost immediately.
That's right.
And simultaneous to the deployment of transgender as the new thing.
The new
victim. And then transgender, even like that became too white. And so then they were like black trans women exclusively. You know, it's just like, that's how Democrats function. That's how they operate. You know, to an extent, it's how all politicians operate. But really, Democrats, and they gain power through this appropriation of minorities and highlighting of certain minorities and manipulation of the public's mind surrounding those issues.
Right. They need a group that they're going to save that's vulnerable or a danger. And then they need an enemy who is the threat to that group. So it would be like, classically, it would be like Black people versus rednecks. And so we're going to send the federal government down south a few times to protect the Black people from the rednecks in the South, right?
Yeah.
And so liberalism is always producing victims to save. And it's also producing oppressors of those victims. It has to produce a complete narrative, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about your influences. Let's do this. It's a great list. So, I mean, Camille Paglia, you talk about her the most. She's probably the biggest influence. And I think I might've asked you about when you first read it. Maybe I didn't. What, do you remember first reading her and what the experience was like? Just the feeling?
Yeah. I found out about her through the audio commentary she did on Basic Instinct on the DVD. And I bought Sexual Personae, Vamps and Tramps, and Sex, Art, and American Culture. And that was the first time that I truly felt like, you know, after Shock Value, after John Waters and everything, that there was like someone out there like me, because my kind of like suspicion about the people I knew who were Democrats, liberals, I really never felt like I fit in. Mm-hmm. And then Paglia gives this sweeping, all-encompassing framework with which to view human history, art. It's just like really, which provides you like infinite freedom too. She was stigmatized as a reactionary because of her nostalgic streak and because she dislikes modern feminism, and she's not at all. Like, that's the path forward for open-minded people, and that's why she's constantly subject to cancel campaigns and stuff, because she's an appealing path forward for a lot of people who don't fit in the polarized political spectrum. But reading that before I really went through college was essential. And I think that everybody should be exposed to Paglia from as young an age as possible, because the beyond her actual content and her critiques, the most valuable thing is how she trains you to communicate, which is the opposite of how academia trains you to communicate. She's very clear-spoken, speaks in generalizations that you can understand. Some might call it didactic. Mm-hmm. There's no self-doubt. She speaks in declarative sentences. Mm-hmm. And this activates like the lizard brain in people who have spent like 10 years in academia, because that whole process is training you to speak in these cute little math problems where everything is uncertain and you can't really be called on anything. So it was devastating when feminists in the early 90s read Sexual Personae and its declarative sentence, like reading the Bible. And that's how I speak. And also her main point about remaining accessible. You can talk about art, you can talk about history, you can talk about complex, crazy experimental subjects and remain accessible to regular people. But academia trains you that no, you have to go through this whole Scientology process in order to only be read by certain people. Mm-hmm. And that makes you better than others. And so Paglia has always been speaking to a general audience, and that's her popularity. That's the reason for her popularity. And she always reiterates her main points, which is something you have to do if you're like a talking head type person with an idea. You can't just, you know, smugly come in the room and be like, I assume everyone has read my entire catalog. No, you have to reiterate that.
every good teacher knows that you have to repeat what you're saying many, many times for people to get it.
And she's a teacher. That's why.
And she's a teacher. Yeah. So tell me, so what is the path? I don't know her work very well. I've heard her speak a few times. I'm ashamed of this. I should have read her stuff. I certainly should have read Sexual Personae a long time ago, but I haven't. What is the path forward that she presents?
It's a combination of open-minded appreciation of art and a respect for tradition and a kind of common sense morality, and basically not being swept up by puritanical forces that try to keep you from expanding your mind. She's a very psychedelic 60s thinker that's all about just consuming as many different subjects as possible, as much art as possible. But her main thesis, you know, when she started writing Sexual Personae in the late 60s, and her thesis then was that sadomasochism and gender aberrance, transgender ideology are aspects of a dying civilization at the end of its lifespan. And she said that 40 years ago, and she's been proven right every step of the way, because all COVID is all a sadomasochistic ritual. Society is so antiseptic and anti-sexual on all ends that it's like all sexuality is sublimated in online morality crusades and COVID S&M performances.
Anna Kachian calls the masking, she calls it white Sharia.
Yeah, it's not even as romantic as Sharia. It's like so much lamer. Yeah,
exactly. So so how is she not reactionary?
Okay, she is reactionary in the way that she is always observing how culture used to be better, like movies specifically, art used to be better. Like that, you're seen as a reactionary if you
fashion
talk frankly about how the quality of things has decreased. But she's not reactionary, because that kind of open-mindedness and a genuine like libertarian freedom is nowhere right now. Everyone, like the sort of traditional right, is really embarrassing and cringe and doesn't speak to anyone's current life or reality. This idea that you can just kind of ape the 1950s, that like 20 year old men can just buy a house and find a virginal woman, and it's ridiculous. Like, no, that's no one's experience now. Paulia, she is not reactionary because of the emphasis she places on the individual, you know, like on individual judgment, individual thought. Like feminists are always trying to and liberals are always trying to place blame on societal structures, and, you know, create this utopia where you're not responsible for your own actions, like, because those, nothing is ever allowed to happen to you. So yeah, it's just like, it reads Sexual Personae and it's not reactionary.
let me propose, I have not, as I said, I don't know her work, but I'm, from what you're saying, what I've heard from her, let me ask you this. It sounds to me like, at least on one level, maybe she doesn't say this explicitly, but she is critiquing egalitarianism, which to me, and I bet it is to her, and I bet it is to you, is necessarily puritanical. Right? Because to make everyone equal is not just making everyone equal, it's also making everyone the same.
Yeah.
At least to some major extent.
Right? Yeah. Voicing any kind of like hierarchy of quality.
Yes.
Is anti-liberal, anti-egalitarian.
That's right. Right.
Because everyone's...
So dressing up like, you know, dressing up like a drag queen, or dressing up like a femme fatale, or, you know, that's not good because that's setting you apart and above, you know, other people. And so that must be squashed. We must all wear beige, right? I'm kind of
moving. Not even beige, it's gray.
Or whatever. Yeah, it's something neutral you don't notice, right? Same with houses.
Everything is just gray now.
And if you're a billionaire, right, you don't show your house. You know, and you also, the colors of the house will be what? Black, white, and gray and beige nowadays. That's the dominant palette, right, for houses. But yeah, I mean, I would imagine that it sounds to me like she's really, that's sort of the thing that she's critiquing underneath all of this, is this egalitarian push to make people not just equal under the law, which is fine, right? But to make them the same, to assimilate everyone into the dominant culture, the dominant sort of formal, boring, bourgeois, white, middle class, puritanical culture of America, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And Polya, she's also a Democrat, but like if Democrats actually stood for what they claim to stand for, like she actually does stand up for regular working class people and constantly draws attention in a way that no Harvard feminist does to how working class men allow the infrastructure of our lavish lifestyles and society where we can all sit online all day, you know, indulging in our narcissistic rape fantasies. That's just working class men who wordlessly and thanklessly maintain all of that. And they don't get any credit. She's always given them credit. And honestly, it's something people don't think about. Like you think, oh, that's everyone knows that. Everyone knows that it's constantly just like, you know, kind of faceless, tired looking working class men and Wranglers repairing the power lines and the power grid. Yeah. I didn't think about it before Polya.
Who laid the cable for your internet? Who laid the cable for the internet in your house that you're sitting in?
It's hopeless with the ice storm in Texas a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
It's like you can't do anything once your phone runs out of battery and you have no running water. We're all useless.
who makes this possible, what we're doing right now? It's a bunch of dudes in Wranglers. Yeah. And Carhartt maybe. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Polya, that's interesting. Now, I listed I left him out. This must have been some Freudian omission here, but your list of influences includes the Marquis de Sade.
Oh yeah, I love Sade.
Yeah. Tell us about Sade. I mean, no one really reads him anymore, I don't think.
No.
We've all heard the name and we all think he's about sadism, which he really isn't.
No, it's far worse than that.
Yeah,
it's so much worse than any idea anyone has of what he's actually about. I first read I read the 120 Days of Sodom when I was 14, and I would read the most grim, horrible passages aloud, like to like my goth friends in science class and stuff. And I early on just had a thirst for whatever the most extreme art and literature was, and yeah, that, you know, really warped my mind. fast forward to the present day. Okay, nobody reads Sade. First of all, nobody actually reads it.
Right.
People who do read a bit of it, they read 120 Days of Sodom because Pasolini's Cello is so popular. And that's not the best one. It's unfinished and it's short. Everybody hates it because it's genuinely evil and genuinely shows in a way that no other work does what happens when people are totally amoral libertines beyond the law, indulging every fantasy with no capacity for empathy. So like Sade is at the root of Ayn Rand, the Church of Satan, that Gen X kind of like this sort of emphasizing this kind of immature selfishness, which I don't even agree. I'm a very like, I care so much about like people and what people think. Like the most disturbing parts of Sade for me are not even the sexual violence, but it's the emotional manipulation that he describes, like all of his heroes and heroines, the way that they just ruthlessly manipulate their own like families and friends in this just Machiavellian evil way is like more disturbing than this cartoonish pornography. But I have this love of maximalist works, giant uncontainable tomes that no one reads anymore. And Sade was a huge fan of Samuel Richardson, one of the first novelists who wrote Pamela and Clarissa, two books that are some of my favorites that no one at all reads anymore, that are about...
Oh, yeah.
Pamela is the first popular novel, and it's about a girl who is constantly being sexually pursued by her employer, and eventually because she is moral and holds out and never gives in to it. She turns him and marries him and lives happily ever after. And this is an epistolary novel. It all happens in letters. I read it at work on Project Gutenberg when I was supposed to be editing romance novels. It's interminable. It's really difficult to read, but it's fun in a way. Once you kind of like acquire a taste for 18th century literature, is that the right century? 18th, 1700s? Yeah. Once you acquire a taste for that, you start to like it. Clarissa is 1500 pages long. Wow. The typeface of a phone book. Took me almost nothing happens. It's this claustrophobic journey into a woman's head who is forced out of her family. A libertine, a rake, seduces her and is constantly scheming to rape her. He eventually succeeds. Okay, so Saad was a huge fan of Richardson and did two novels, a novel sequence, Justine and Juliet, that right. were his satanic evil spin on Pamela and Clarissa. Justine is short, and it's about the good sister who, like Pamela, is doing the morally correct thing, and she meets misfortune at every turn because she has this religious conviction, and she's just relentlessly put in dungeons, basements, tortured by people, dies at the end. And then her sister, Juliet, which is this, again, 1500 page massive novel, is the evil one who is like the Saadian heroine who does everything out of total self-interest and like rises up in the world, is rewarded at every turn for being evil. And in a way, it's like a predecessor of the kind of gigantic doorstop like 70s and 80s shopping and fucking romance epics like Scruples and Sins that I love, where women rise up in the, you know, the magazine industry and stuff. But Juliet, like, it just changes you, spending that much time in this criminally insane head. And I think, you know, I'm a Christian, but I feel like evil art often reinforces your own moral center. Most people on the right do not like this, do not like anything like Saad, or there's a movie that's really that I'm obsessed with called Melancholy Der Engel, stuff that's really beyond the pale in terms of morality and what it's saying about human existence. But Saad just makes you think in a way, and it requires a certain commitment, and there's the didactic camp element, like the declarative sentences, like that's a big influence on Polya. Like Sexual Personae is much like Juliet. And so
it's direct. There's none of the passive aggressiveness that you get in a lot of feminist writing or a lot of liberal writing generally. It's direct.
And, you know, the way people think about Saad, you read any kind of like review online of any of these books, no one likes them. And then last year, Aileen and Valcour, one of his untranslated novels, came out in an English translation for the first time. And there was this, maybe it was a New York Times like article about how no one needs to read Saad in the age of Jeffrey Epstein. And it was really like prissy and, you know, like it could have been from 1952, but like, Saad was such a huge mind-expanding influence in the 60s. He was so popular because of those Grove Press paperback editions of these books. And he was a huge part of the sexual revolution. And you see this through so many experimental art filmmakers and writers of that time. And he's just nowhere, very unfashionable.
So summarize Saad, like the major argument that he's making, the overarching argument, like what is he saying that was especially attractive to counterculture people in the 60s?
That you can liberate your, that you don't need to answer to anyone, that you should not answer to any form of sexual morality.
Okay.
Any kind of personal morality is basically doing away with every aspect of morality that you could possibly think of.
I like
and
it.
Empathy and, you know.
I like it. Now, wait, you just said you're a Christian?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, it's not like I go to church. I was raised Southern Baptist. That's kind of like incidental. Mm-hmm. People always assume I'm Catholic. I have a kind of Catholic personality, I guess. Everyone's Catholic now online. It's a big trend, but I'm not Catholic.
Yeah.
I'm very Protestant in the way that I think the only thing that matters is your personal relationship with Jesus and prayer. Your personal relationship with God. But you know, prayer has gotten me through the hardest parts of my life. You know, my Christianity is basically just cause and effect. And I think a lot of people experience it this way. And it's just like, if you are in a dark period of your life that you feel like you absolutely cannot get out of, and prayer helps you, having a belief in a higher power helps you, then, you know, your life becomes better.
Hmm. Whether or not it's true.
Yeah. I mean, you can doubt all you want. Like I believe it's true, but it's just like, why?
Doesn't matter.
It's like taking a pill and suddenly the world looks brighter. Everything goes better for me. And then the opposite, you know, descending into these satanic evil works like Sod and Melancholy Durangle or whatever, like the world looks darker, things go wrong. But I still am like fascinated by that. It's like taking a drug.
Yeah.
But I do think that like a Christian moral center keeps you from being swayed by the insanity of current liberalism. You know, if you don't know what to believe, then you start believing in climate change. What's more embarrassing than that?
You know who I think you would like a lot?
Mm-hmm.
At least I hope you would. I would love to hear what I want is for you. I would love to hear what you think about him. Michel Foucault. I mean, I don't know if I'm sure you've been told about him a zillion times. Have you ever dipped into Foucault at all?
I did. I did, you know, I did half of a master's degree in English, and I read, I think, History of Sexuality, and like did a little. I didn't mind it. I think he, after being popular for so long, for like 40 years, there's kind of like a sort of puritanical reaction against him, which is really funny. Like I see a lot of like bugs online being like, he was just a sexual pervert who fisted people and gave them AIDS. Right. And like when Polya, you know, she rails against Foucault and French post-structuralism, whatever all that's called. And it was kind of a different time, but like, I don't hate Foucault. I do think it's, you know, it's less accessible and like punchy than I would like, but it's interesting. But yeah, as soon as I see those little morality crusades, especially from the left, especially from like the online kind of like dirtbag left, like, oh no, honey. Like every time they've glommed on to some kind of morality crusade, I just like, let's examine the opposite.
Yeah, I think Madness and Civilization, which is his first book, which is a history of the asylum, but it's really a history of the ways.
I think I've read that one.
Yeah, it's the ways in which civilization, Western civilization, has created and recreated illness, mental illness and insanity, right? Basically to punish dissidents and punish people who, you know, are different. I think it's just right up your alley, and it's definitely his most accessible book. But I think it's a lot of what you say and think, I think, is very consistent with Foucault, especially in that book. I'd love to hear you talk about it sometime, but.
So my problem with what I remember of Foucault was that people latch onto this idea that he purveys that like before the Victorian age, the 20th century, maybe there was like no sexual morality, no sexual framework. This is all entirely invented. Before this was this, like, you know, utopia of like having butt sex in the hay, and no one said anything.
Yeah.
I just don't buy it. It's not true. It's a kind of like simplistic, almost fetishistic view of history. It's interesting. I understand why people gravitate towards it, but it's like just not the whole truth. I don't believe there was this like pastoral sexual utopia, you know, during the Dark Ages.
Yeah, no, that's a very smart critique of him, and he's not great at sort of demonstrating clearly that the pre-modern era was the way he suggests it was. Although I think you're a little off in the way he's portrays it. His claim about it is simply that there wasn't talk, there wasn't discourse about things mm-hmm. like homosexuality. And like homosexuality wasn't even invented until 1868, I think, as a term, right? Yeah. And pedophilia and incest, it just weren't part of the discourse. You didn't have doctors and psychiatrists and government officials and priests and, you know, clergy talking about these things mm-hmm. until about the 18th and 19th centuries when they just became obsessed with it. So it's just that he's saying that, you know, we don't know really what the world was like back then in terms of sex or other things, right? But we do know that there were no anti-homosexual campaigns, for instance. There were no anti-pedophile campaigns. And so we just assume that there was a bunch of, you know, what we would now call homosexuality or pedophilia or pederasty going on that wasn't punished or even commented on. But again, it's all, he really just speculates on that. It's not like he can prove this, that for, you know, two millennia, no one talked about these things and no one did anything to anybody who was ass fucking or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
But I do think it's an important, I just think it's a fascinating point that's probably at least partly right. And it tells us a lot about the power of discourse and language, right? Like once we get, it's very much your way of thinking. Yeah. Once you get these ways of thinking, it doesn't matter what the real world is, right? Mm-hmm. Once this stuff is in your head, it doesn't matter what's going on all around you. You still think it's full of rapists named Chad or whatever it is, right? So I do think you would, I would just like to hear, I don't know if you would benefit from it, but I'd actually just like to hear your mind interact with it at some point.
Yeah, I would like to visit it more in depth, but you know, I have Foucault in the like category.
Okay. Good. All right. Last, we're not going to get into all your influences, but I'm so embarrassed by this. I'm going to make a huge admission that I really shouldn't do publicly, but I'm going to do it because I like you so much. So one of your major influences you list is Margaret Mitchell, the author of Gone with the Wind. Everybody's heard of it. Became, of course, the most famous movie in American history. And it became even more infamous lately because Donald Trump, what was it, last year, 2 years ago, talked about how he wishes the Academy Awards used to give out the best picture to films like Gone with the Wind instead of Korean movies, non-American movies.
Yeah, that was one of his best moments. Great movies. Sunset Boulevard, Gone with the Wind.
And he's like,
I felt like the Matrix had like broken and he was thinking,
I think that was the most politically incorrect thing he's ever said, which is saying something, right? He's like,
yeah,
Korean movie. What's wrong with Gone with the Wind? I'm like, dude, do you not know what people think of Gone with the Wind? Like they consider it to be the same exact same as, you know, saying,
but they don't actually think that when they watch it. That's the thing. It's like, well, you know, all the liberal, all the bugs, they're acting on, you know, a little facile network of what they perceive they're supposed to think online, but
I want you to do what you're about to do here, but let me tell you, make my horrible admission. Guess what? I have
never seen it.
I've never read or seen Gone with the Wind.
Oh, it's
pathetic.
I mean, it's the most popular movie and the most popular book ever written for a reason.
I got it. So do it. Tell us about Gone with the Wind and why you think it's so great and why you love it and why everyone's wrong about it.
The movie is the highest achievement of filmmaking. You know, 1939 is thought of as the best year for movies ever, the real golden age. It was bigger, brighter, funnier, smarter, more epic than anything that had come before or came after. All of the pieces came into place in this really chaotic assembly line production with like three different directors. You would never know what a disaster the production of it was from how smooth and perfect the final product is. Of course, it has been unpopular with certain types of people for a long time because they dismissively call it a soap opera. Mm-hmm. This is something that like straight men often do when they don't like dealing with woman stuff. They call it a the soap opera, you know, which is saying nothing. Like they say this about like television shows they don't like now. Like, it's just a soap opera. No, it's all a soap opera that doesn't, that just indicates that you think it's girl stuff. And that, you know, the book is thought of completely incorrectly because it's this smart flapper liberated woman 30s acid-tongued satire, and it's, you know, these like liberals and everything try to make it just this apologia for slavery. That's not what you get at all. It's like it's more like Dorothy Parker. Like Margaret Mitchell was she was a flapper. She's like a D.H. Lawrence character. She's like Gudrun or Ursula, you know. She but she's Southern, so people don't, you know, they think you cannot possibly have any contributions to culture if you're Southern. But even then, even when it came out, it was hugely controversial because she didn't have the right politics. And my initial surprise with it when I finally read it was just how funny and brilliantly conceived every single line was. And, you know, just venomous satire of women, of the nature of women. Every line is hilarious. It's the epic scope of it. The way that she combines this 30s flapper satire with a Civil War historical epic is truly impressive. And Scarlett O'Hara is such a modern character, both in the movie as acted by Vivian Leigh and in the book, in this way that like almost no one, like depictions of women from like 20 years ago feel dated in a way that Scarlett O'Hara doesn't, because it's just so ruthless about her character that she's such a scheming and conniving but and awful person, but she succeeds. That's why she succeeds in Reconstruction, in the Reconstruction South, because she is ruthless. And, you know, it's a story of women entering the workplace before they really entered the workplace. It's all of these things. It has the best ending of all time, of course. The fact that this woman gets her comeuppance and she finally, Rhett Butler leaves her in the end after she has ruined her reputation, you know, alienated everyone who loves her throughout the entire thing, been totally greedy, done anything for money. She's a Saudian hero, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, the characterizations are complex and wonderful, but like it is, people don't like it because they recognize a ring of truth to the whole thing. And okay, I'll put something forth,
please.
We're supposed to currently think that the depiction of Black people in mediocre modern movies, where they're just props, stand-ins for Democrat propaganda, where they have to be always depicted as scientists who all of their culture, all of their, you know, accent, all their language, all their traditions, you can't have any of that.
Yes.
Because it's a, so.
Exactly.
That sucks. Hattie McDaniel in Gone with the Wind is an amazing performance, an amazing actress. The first Black actress who won an Academy Award, and she's a star. She jumps off the screen. You can't tell me that I'm supposed to prefer these like Bank of America commercials with like natural haired, like mixed race women paying their student loans to Hattie McDaniel as Mammy.
Nice. Yes. I'm going to watch it. I'm sure you're right. I love it.
Butterfly McQueen too. It's like,
yes,
it makes people uncomfortable now. It made people uncomfortable then. And this is why it's so timeless and so essential. And like, I feel like I sometimes get made fun of for like my relentless championing of it and getting really angry about the attempts to withdraw it from circulation all the time, which they're like, that'll never happen. That's what they always say. That'll never happen. Maybe. You're a freak for worrying about it. No, they do it. They do it. It happens every day. Like things get zapped off of streaming, you know, and they make it against terms of service to sell them on Amazon and eBay. And then guess what? If you want it, you'll have to pay $200. Some maybe. Black market.
I love it. Maybe we should, God, I want you to, maybe we should teach like a course where we just watch Gone with the Wind and give critiques of it.
Oh my God. That would be amazing. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can talk about everything in the context of Gone with the Wind.
Yeah. Yeah. And everyone agrees it's, you know, one of the most important facet aspects of American culture ever. So it's, it's not an unimportant text as a movie or a book. I would love to do that and just have everybody come and participate and have you give your critique and we could all watch it and have our own critiques. That'd be amazing.
But
you and I, we've got to sit down and figure out a Jack course. I want to do a course where you bring all this together, kind of like you're doing now, but in a much more fleshed out way. And also, we didn't even get to like Samuel Delaney, Madonna. We talked a little bit about Waters, Todd Haynes, other people. But yeah, pull it all together. And also, you also call yourself queer and hippie in your influences, you know? So like how that all gets brought, and there's a very, very heavy dose of conservatism in you too, right? And how that all gets brought together is just, I love it. And it's also hilarious and entertaining. As was this conversation, Jack, thank you. We're done for now, but I'm not done with you. Thanks for coming back on.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
It's so much fun talking to you. You really, I don't think I've ever laughed this hard. No, I have not in an unregistered episode. And I've interviewed comedians, many of them. So.
I'm glad you like it.
Thank you so much, man. Okay. Yeah. We'll be in touch soon, Jack. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.